But you should know that you are not alone. There are hundreds of Saudis just like you. Good Muslims whose loved ones were killed by the Americans, or are rotting to this day in the cages of Guantanamo Bay. And many have come to the brothers in search of revenge.
None of them watched their father being murdered in cold blood.
You believe this makes you special?
No, Nadia said. I believe it is my money that makes me special.
Very special, the Sheikh said. It's been 5 years since your father was martyred, has it not?
Nadia nodded.
That is a long time, Miss Al-Bakari.
In the Nejd, it is the blink of an eye.
We expected you sooner. We even sent our brother Samir to make contact with you. But you rejected his entreaties.
It wasn't possible for me to help you at the time.
Why not?
I was being watched.
By whom?
By everyone, she said, including the Al-Saud.
They warned you against taking any action to avenge your father's death?
In no uncertain terms.
They said there would be financial consequences?
They didn't go into specifics, except to say the consequences would be grave.
And you believed them?
Why wouldn't I?
Because they are liars.
Bin Taib allowed his words to hang in the air for a moment.
How do I know that you are not a spy sent here by the Al-Saud to entrap me?
How do I know that you are not the spy, Sheikh bin Taib? After all, you are the one who's on the Al-Saud payroll.
So are you, Miss Al-Bakari. At least that's the rumor.
Nadia gave the Sheikh a withering look. She could only imagine how she must have appeared to him, two coal black eyes glaring over a black niqab. Perhaps there was value to the veil after all.
Try to see it from our point of view, Miss Al-Bakari,
bin Taib continued.
In the 5 years since your father's martyrdom, you have said nothing about him in public. You seem to spend as little time in Saudi Arabia as possible. You smoke, you drink, you shun the veil, except, of course, when you are trying to impress me with your piety. And you throw away hundreds of millions of dollars on infidel art.
Obviously the Sheikh's test was not yet over. Nadia remembered the last words Gabriel had spoken to her at Chateau Treville.
You're Zizi's daughter. Never let them forget it. Perhaps you're right, Sheikh bin Taib. Perhaps I should have cloaked myself in a burqa and declared my intention to avenge my father's death on television. Surely that would have been the wiser course of action.
The Sheikh gave a conciliatory smile.
I've heard all about your wicked tongue, he said.
I have my father's tongue, and the last time I heard his voice, he was bleeding to death in my arms.
And now you want vengeance.
I want justice. God's justice.
And what of the Al-Saud?
They seem to have lost interest in me.
I'm not surprised, bin Taib said. Even the House of Saud isn't sure whether it's going to survive the turmoil sweeping the Arab world. They need friends wherever they can find them, even if they happen to wear the short tobes and unkempt beards of the Salaf.
Nadia couldn't believe what she was hearing. If the Sheikh was speaking the truth, the rulers of Saudi Arabia had renewed the Faustian bargain, the deal with the devil that led to 9/11 and countless other deaths after that. The Al-Saud had no choice, she thought. They were like a man holding a tiger by the ears. If they kept their grip on the beast, they might survive a little longer. But if they released it, they would be devoured in an instant.
Do the Americans know about this? She asked.
The so-called special relationship between the Americans and the House of Saud is a thing of the past, bin Taib said. As you know, Miss Al-Bakari, Saudi Arabia is forming new alliances and finding new customers for its oil. The Chinese don't care about things like human rights and democracy. They pay their bills on time, and they don't poke their noses into things that are none of their business.
Things like jihad? She asked.
The Sheikh nodded.
The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, taught us there were five pillars of Islam. We believe there is a sixth. Jihad is not a choice. It is an obligation. The Al-Saud understand this. Once again, they are willing to look the other way, provided the brothers don't make trouble inside the kingdom. That was bin Laden's biggest mistake.
Bin Laden is dead, said Nadia, and so is his group. I'm interested in the one who can make bombs go off in the cities of Europe.
Then you are interested in the Yemeni.
Do you know him?
I've met him.
Do you have the ability to speak to him?
That is a dangerous question. And even if I could speak to him, I certainly wouldn't bother to tell him about a rich Saudi woman who is looking for vengeance. You have to believe in what you are doing.
I am the daughter of Abdulaziz al-Bakari, and a descendant of Muhammad Abdul Wahhab. I certainly believe in what I am doing, and I am after far more than just vengeance.
What are you after?
Nadia hesitated. The next words were not her own. They had been dictated to her by the man who had killed her father.
I wish only to resume the work of Abdulaziz al-Bakari, she said gravely. I will place the money in the hands of the Yemeni to do with as he pleases. And perhaps, if God wills it, bombs will one day explode in the streets of Washington and Tel Aviv.
I suspect he would be most grateful, the Sheikh said carefully. But I am certain he will be unable to offer any sort of guarantees.
I'm not looking for any guarantees, only a pledge that he will use the money wisely and carefully.
You are proposing a one-time payment?
No, Sheikh bin Taib. I am proposing a long-term relationship. He will attack them, and I will pay for it.
How much money are you willing to provide?
As much as he needs.
The Sheikh smiled.
Alhamdulillah.
Nadia remained in the tent of the Sheikh for another hour. Then she followed the Talib along the edge of the wadi to her car. The skies poured with rain during the drive back to Riyadh, and it was still raining later the following morning when Nadia and her entourage boarded their plane for the flight back to Europe. Once clear of Saudi airspace, she removed her niqab and abaya and changed into a pale Chanel suit. Then she telephoned Thomas Fowler at his estate north of Paris to say that her meetings in Saudi Arabia had gone better than expected. Fowler immediately placed a call to a little-known venture capital firm in Northern Virginia, a call that was automatically routed to Gabriel's desk in Rashidistan. Gabriel spent the next week carefully monitoring the financial and legal maneuverings of one Samir Abbas of the Trans-Arabian Bank in Zurich. Then, after dining poorly with Carter at a seafood restaurant in McLean, he headed back to London. Carter let him take an agency Gulfstream. No handcuffs, no hypodermic needles, no hard feelings. 44. St. James's, London. On the day after Gabriel's return to London, the venerable Christie's auction house announced a surprise addition to its upcoming sale of Venetian old masters. Madonna and Child with Mary Magdalene, oil on canvas, 110 by 92 centimetres, previously attributed to the workshop of Palmavecchio, now firmly attributed to none other than the great Titian himself. By midday, the phones inside Christie's were ringing off the hook, and by day's end, no fewer than 40 important museums and collectors had dipped their oars into the water. That evening, the atmosphere in the bar at Green's restaurant was electric, though Julian Isherwood was notably not among those present. "Saw him getting into a cab in Duke Street," Jeremy Crabb muttered into his gin and bitters. "Looked positively dreadful, poor sod. Said he was planning to spend a quiet evening alone with his cough." It is rare that a painting by an artist like Titian resurfaces, and when one does, it is usually accompanied by a good story. Such was certainly the case with Madonna and Child with Mary Magdalene, though whether it was tragedy, comedy, or morality tale depended entirely on who was doing the telling. Christie's released an abridged version for the sake of the painting's official provenance, but in the little West London village of St. James's it was immediately written off as well-sanitized hogwash. Eventually there came to exist an unofficial version of the story that unfolded roughly along the following lines. It seemed that at some point the previous August, an unidentified Norfolk nobleman of great title but shrinking resources reluctantly decided to part with a portion of his art collection. This nobleman made contact with a London art dealer, also unidentified, and asked whether he might be willing to accept the assignment. This London art dealer was busy at the time. Truth be told, he was sunning himself in the Costa del Sol, and it was late September before he was able to make his way to the nobleman's estate. The dealer found the collection lackluster, to put it mildly, though he did agree to take several paintings off the nobleman's hands, including a very dirty work attributed to some hack in the workshop of Palmavecchio. The amount of money that changed hands was never disclosed. It was said to be quite small. For reasons not made clear, the dealer allowed the paintings to languish in his storage rooms before commissioning a hasty cleaning of the aforementioned Palmavecchio. The identity of the restorer was never revealed, though all agreed he gave a rather good account of himself in a remarkably short period of time. Indeed, the painting was in such fine shape that it managed to catch the wandering eye of one Oliver Dimbleby, the noted old master dealer from Berry Street. Oliver acquired it in a trade. The other paintings involved were never disclosed, and promptly hung it in his gallery, viewable by appointment only. It would not remain there long, however. In fact, just 48 hours later, it was purchased by something called Onyx Innovative Capital, a limited liability investment firm registered in the Swiss city of Lucerne. Oliver didn't deal directly with OIC, but rather with an agreeable bloke named Samir Abbas of the Trans-Arabian Bank. After thrashing out the final details over tea at the Dorchester Hotel, Abbas presented Oliver with a cheque for £22,000. Oliver quickly deposited the money into his account at Lloyd's Bank, thus consecrating the sale, and began the messy process of securing the necessary export license. It was at this point that the affair took a disastrous turn, at least from Oliver's point of view, because on a dismal afternoon in late January there came to Oliver's gallery a rumpled figure dressed in many layers of clothing who, with a single offhand question, sent the apples rolling across the proverbial floor. Oliver would never reveal the identity of the man, except to say he was learned in the field of Italian Renaissance art, particularly the Venetian school. As for the question posed by this man, Oliver was willing to repeat it verbatim. In fact, for the price of a good glass of Sancerre, he would act out the entire scene. For Oliver loved nothing more than to tell stories on himself, especially when they were less than flattering, which was almost always the case.
"I say, Oliver, old chap, but is that Titian spoken for?" "Not a Titian, my good man." "Sure about that? Positive as I can be." "Who is it, then?"
"Palma."
"Really? Rather good for a Palma. Workshop or the man himself?"
"Workshop, love, workshop."
It was then the rumpled figure leaned precariously forward to have a closer look, a lean that Oliver recreated nightly at Green's to uproarious laughter.
"Sold, is it?" asked the rumpled figure, tugging at his earlobe.
"Just last week," said Oliver.
"As a palmer?"
"Workshop, love, workshop."
"How much?"
"My good man, if I were you, I'd find some way to wriggle out of it."
"Whatever for?"
"Look at the draftsmanship, look at the brushwork. You just let a Titian slip through your fingers. Shame on you, Oliver. Hang your head. Confess your sins."
Oliver did neither. But within minutes he was on the phone to an old chum at the British Museum, who had forgotten more about Titian than most art historians would ever know. The chum hurried over to St. James's in a deluge, and stood before the canvas looking like the only survivor of a shipwreck.
"Oliver, how could you?
Is it that obvious?
I'd stake my reputation on it."
"At least you have one. Mine will be in the loo if this gets out."
"You do have one option."
"What's that?"
"Call Mr. Abbas. Tell him the cheque bounced."
And don't think the idea didn't cross Oliver's devious little mind. In fact, he spent the better part of the next 48 hours trying to find some legally and morally acceptable loophole that he might use to extricate himself from the deal. Finding none, at least not one that would allow him to sleep at night, he called Mr. Abbas to inform him that Onyx Innovative Capital was actually the proud owner of a newly discovered Titian. Oliver offered to take the painting to market. hoping to at least salvage a healthy commission out of the debacle, but Abbas called back the very next day to say OIC was going in a different direction.
"Tried to let me down easy," Oliver said wistfully. "Pleasure doing business with you, Mr. Dimbleby. Lunch next time you're in Zurich, Mr. Dimbleby. And by the way, Mr. Dimbleby, the lads from Christie's will be stopping by in an hour."
They appeared with the suddenness of professional kidnappers, and carried the painting over to King Street, where it was examined by a parade of Titian experts from around the globe. Each rendered the same verdict, and, miraculously, not one violated the draconian confidentiality agreement that Christie's had made them sign for their fee. Even the normally loquacious Oliver managed to keep quiet until after Christie's unveiled its prize. But then Oliver had reason to hold his tongue. Oliver was the goat who let a Titian slip through his hooves. But even Oliver seemed to find a bit of pleasure in the frenzy that followed the announcement, and why ever not? It really had been a dreadful winter till that point, with the government austerity and the blizzards and the bombings. Oliver was only happy he was able to lighten the mood, even if it meant playing the fool for drinks at Green's. Besides, he knew the role well. He had played it many times before, to great acclaim. On the night of the auction, he gave what would be his final performance to a standing-room-only crowd. At its conclusion, he made 3 curtain calls, then joined the throng heading over to Christie's for the big show. Management had been kind enough to reserve a second-row seat for him, directly in front of the auctioneer's rostrum. Seated to his left was his friend and competitor, Roddy Hutchinson, and to Roddy's left was Julian Isherwood. The seat to Oliver's right was unoccupied. A moment later it was filled by none other than Nicholas Lovegrove, art advisor to the vastly rich. Lovegrove had just flown in from New York. Private, of course. Lovegrove didn't do commercial anymore.
"Why the long face, Ollie?"
"Thoughts of what might have been."
"Sorry about the Titian."
"Win some, lose some."
"How's biz, Nicky?"
"Can't complain."
"Didn't realize you dabbled in old masters."
"Actually, they terrify me. Look at this place. It's like being in a bloody church. All angels and saints and martyrdom and crucifixion."
"So what brings you to town?"
"A client who wants to venture into new territory."
"Client have a name?"
"Client wishes to remain anonymous. Very anonymous."
"Know the feeling. Your client planning to venture into new territory by acquiring a Titian?"
"You'll know soon enough, Ollie."
"Hope your client has deep pockets."
"I only do deep pockets."
"Word on the street is that it's going to go big."
"Pre-show hype."
"I'm sure you're right, Nicky. You're always right."
Lovegrove didn't bother to dispute this. Instead, he drew a mobile phone from the breast pocket of his blazer and scrolled through the contacts. Oliver being Oliver, he snuck a quick peek at the screen after Lovegrove placed the call.
"Now isn't that interesting?" he thought. "Isn't that interesting indeed?"
45. St. James's, London. The painting entered the room at the midway point, like a pretty girl arriving at a party fashionably late. It had been a rather dull party until that moment, and the pretty girl did much to brighten the room. Oliver Dimbleby sat up a bit straighter in his folding chair. Julian Isherwood fussed with the knot of his necktie and winked at one of the women on the telephone dais.
"Lot 27, the Titian?"
purred Simon Mendenhall, Christie's slinky chief auctioneer. Simon was the only man in London with a suntan. It was beginning to smudge the collar of his custom-made shirt.
"Shall we begin at 2 million?
Terry O'Connor, the last Irish tycoon with any money, did the honours. Within 30 seconds the bid in the room stood at £6.5 million. Oliver Dimbleby leaned to his right and murmured,
"Still think it was hype, Nicky?"
"We're still in the first turn," Lovegrove whispered, "and I hear there's a strong headwind on the backstretch."
"I'd recheck the forecast if I were you, Nicky."
The bidding stalled at 7. Oliver, with a scratch of his nose, nudged it to 7.5.
"Bastard,"
muttered Lovegrove.
"Any time, Nicky."
Oliver's bid reignited the frenzy. Terry O'Connor steamrolled his way through several consecutive bids, but the other contenders refused to back down. The Irishman finally lowered his paddle at 12, at which point Isherwood accidentally entered the fray when Mendenhall mistook a discreet cough for a bid of £12.5 million. It was no matter. A few seconds later, a telephone bidder stunned the room by offering £15 million. Lovegrove pulled out his phone and dialed. "Where do we stand?" asked Mr. Hamdali. Lovegrove gave him the lay of the land. In the time it had taken him to place the call, the telephone bid had already been eclipsed. It was back in the room with Terry O'Connor at 16. "Mr. O'Connor fancies himself a pugilist, does he not? Welterweight champ at university. Let's hit him with a stiff uppercut, shall we?"
"How stiff?"
"Enough to know we mean business." Lovegrove caught Mendenhall's eye and raised two fingers. "I have 20 million in the room. It's not with you, madam, nor with you, sir, and it's not with Lisa on the telephone. It's in the room with Mr. Lovegrove at £20 million. Do I have 20 million 5?
He did.
It was with Julian Isherwood. Terry O'Connor immediately took it to 21. The telephone bidder counted at 22. The second entered at 24, followed soon after by a third at 25. Mendenhall was twisting and turning like a flamenco dancer. The bidding had taken on the quality of a fight to the death, which was exactly what he wanted. Lovegrove lifted his phone to his ear and said, "Something doesn't smell right to me."
"Bid again, Mr. Lovegrove."
"But
please bid again."
Lovegrove did as he was instructed.
"The bid is now 26 million, in the room, with Mr. Lovegrove. Will someone give me 27?
Lisa waved her hand from the telephone desk.
"I have 28 on the telephone. Now it's 29 at the back of the room. Now 30. Now to 31 with Mr. O'Connor in the room. 32 now. 33. No, I won't take 33.5 because I'm looking for 34. And it looks as though I may have it with Mr. Isherwood. Do I?"
"Yes, I do.
It's in the room, 34 million, with Mr. Isherwood."
"Bid again," said Hamdali.
"I would advise against it."
"Bid again, Mr. Lovegrove, or my client will find an adviser who will."
Lovegrove signalled 35. In the space of a few seconds, the telephone bidders ran it past 40.
"Bid again, Mr. Lovegrove."
"I would
bid."
Mendenhall acknowledged Lovegrove's bid of £42 million.
"Now it's 43 with Lisa on the telephone. Now it's 44 with Samantha. And 45 with Cynthia."
And then came the lull Lovegrove was looking for. He glanced at Terry O'Connor and saw the fight had gone out of him. To Hamdali he said, "How badly does your client want this painting?"
"Badly enough to bid 46.
Lovegrove did so.
"The bid is now 46 in the room with Mr. Lovegrove," said Mendenhall. "Will anyone give me 47?
On the telephone desk, Cynthia began waving her hand as though she were trying to signal a rescue helicopter.
"It's with Cynthia on the phone at $47 million.
No other telephone bidders followed suit.
"Shall we end this?" asked Lovegrove.
"Let's," said Hamdali.
"How much?"
"My client likes round numbers."
Lovegrove arched an eyebrow and raised five fingers.
"The bid is £50 million, said Mendenhall. "It's not with you, sir, nor with Cynthia on the telephone. 50 million in the room for a Titian. Fair warning now. Last chance. All done?"
Not quite, for there was the sharp crack of Mendenhall's gavel and the elated gasp of the crowd, and a final excited exchange with Mr. Hamdali that Lovegrove couldn't quite hear because Oliver Dimbleby was shouting something into his other ear, which he couldn't quite hear either. And then there were the disingenuous handshakes with the losers, and the obligatory flirtation with the press over the identity of the buyer, and the long walk upstairs to Christie's business offices, where the final paperwork was buttoned up with an air of funereal solemnity. It was approaching 10 o'clock by the time Lovegrove signed his name to the last document. He emerged from Christie's portentous doorway to find Oliver and the boys milling about in King Street. They were heading over to Nobu for a spicy tuna roll and a look-see at the latest Russian talent.
"Join us, Nicky!" bellowed Oliver. "Revel in the company of your English brethren. You've been spending too much time in America. You're no bloody fun any longer."
Lovegrove was tempted, but knew the outing was likely to end badly, so he saw them into a caravan of taxis and headed back to his hotel on foot. Walking along Duke Street, he saw a man emerge from Mason's Yard and climb into a waiting car. The man was of medium height and build. The car was a sleek Jaguar sedan that reeked of British officialdom. So did the handsome, silver-haired figure already seated in the back. neither cast so much as a glance in Lovegrove's direction as he walked past, but he had the uncomfortable impression they were sharing a private joke at his expense. He felt the same way about the auction, the auction in which he had just played a starring role. Someone had been had tonight, Lovegrove was sure of it, and he feared it was his client. It was no skin off Lovegrove's back. He had earned several million pounds just for raising his finger in the air a few times. Not a bad way to make a living, he thought, smiling to himself. Perhaps he should have accepted Oliver's invitation to the post-auction bash. No, he thought, rounding the corner into Piccadilly, it was probably better he'd begged off. Things would end badly. They usually did whenever Oliver was involved. 46. Langley, Virginia. 3 business days later, the venerable Christie's Auction House, King Street, St. James's, deposited the sum of £50 million, less commissions, taxes, and numerous transactional fees, into the Zurich branch of Transarabian Bank. Christie's received confirmation of the transfer at 2:18 p.m. London time, as did the 200 men and women gathered in the subterranean ops centre known as Rashidistan. There arose in the room a loud cheer that echoed throughout the chambers of the American intelligence community, and even inside the White House itself. The celebration did not last long, however, for there was a great deal of work to be done. After many weeks of toil and worry, Gabriel's operation had finally borne fruit. Now the harvest would commence, and after the harvest, God willing, would come the feast. The money spent a restful day in Zurich, before moving on to Transarabian's headquarters in Dubai. Not all of it, though. At the direction of Samir Abbas, who had power of attorney, £2 million were wired into a small private bank on Zurich's Talstrasse. Additionally, Abbas authorized large donations to a number of Islamic groups and charities, including the World Islamic Fund for Justice, the Free Palestine Initiative, the Centers for Islamic Studies, the Islamic Society of Western Europe, the Islamic World League, and the Institute for Judeo-Islamic Reconciliation, Gabriel's personal favorite. Abbas also allotted himself a generous consulting fee, which, curiously, he drew in cash. He gave a portion of the money to the imam of his mosque, to do with as he pleased. The rest he concealed in the pantry of his Zurich apartment, an act that was captured by the camera of his compromised computer and projected live onto the giant screens of Rashidistan. Owing to Transarabian's long-suspected links to the global jihadist movement, Langley and the NSA were already well acquainted with its ledger books, as were the terror finance specialists at Treasury and the FBI. As a result, Gabriel and the staff in Rashidistan were able to monitor the money almost in real time, as it flowed through a series of fronts, shells, and dummy corporations, all of which had been hastily created in lax jurisdictions in the days following Nadia's meeting with Sheikh bin Tayyib in the Nejd. The speed with which the money moved from account to account demonstrated that Rashid's network possessed a level of sophistication that belied its size and relative youth. It also revealed, much to Langley's alarm, that the network had already expanded far beyond the Middle East and Western Europe. The evidence of Rashid's global reach was overwhelming. There was the $300,000 that appeared suddenly in the account of a trucking firm in Ciudad del Este, Paraguay, and the $500,000 paid to a commercial construction company in Caracas, and the $800,000 funneled to an internet consulting firm based in Montreal, a firm owned by an Algerian previously linked to Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. The largest single payment, $2 million, went to QTC Logistics, a freight forwarding and customs brokerage firm based in the judicially porous Gulf Emirate of Sharjah. Within hours of the money's arrival, the Rashidistan team was monitoring QTC's phones and poring over its records dating back 3 years. The same was true of the internet firm in Montreal, though the physical surveillance of the Algerian was delegated to the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service. Gabriel argued strenuously against bringing the Canadians into the investigation, but was overruled by Adrian Carter and his newfound ally at the White House, James A. McKenna. It was just one of many battles, large and small, that Gabriel would lose as the operation slipped further and further from his grasp.
As the intelligence streamed into the ops center, the staff produced an updated network matrix that dwarfed the one assembled by Dina and Gabriel's team following the first attacks. McKenna dropped by every few days just to marvel at it, as did members of the various congressional committees involved in intelligence and homeland security. And on a snowy afternoon in late February, Gabriel spotted the president himself, standing on the upper observation deck with the CIA director and Adrian Carter standing proudly at his side. The president was clearly pleased by what he saw. It was clean, it was smart, it was forward-leaning, a partnership between Islam and the West to defeat the forces of extremism. Brain power over brute force. The operation had been Gabriel's creation, Gabriel's work of art. Yet it had so far failed to provide any firm leads regarding the whereabouts of the network's operational mastermind, or its inspirational leader, which is why it came as a surprise to Gabriel when he started hearing rumors about pending arrests. He confronted Adrian Carter the next day in the center's soundproof conference room. Carter spent a moment rearranging the contents of a file, before finally confirming the rumors were true. Gabriel tapped the green badge hanging around his neck and asked, "Does this allow me to offer an opinion?"
"I'm afraid it does."
"You're about to make a mistake, Adrian."
"It wouldn't be my first."
"My team and I went a great deal of time and effort to put this operation in place, and now you're going to blow it sky high by pulling a few operatives off the street."
"I'm afraid you've mistaken me for someone else," Carter said impassively.
"Who's that?"
"Someone who has the power to rule by executive fiat. I'm the Deputy Director for Operations of the Central Intelligence Agency. I have superiors in this building. I have ambitious counterparts from other agencies with competing interests. I have a Director of National Intelligence, Congressional Committees, and James A. McKenna. And, last but not least, I have a President."
"We're spies, Adrian. We don't make arrests. We save lives. You have to be patient, just like your enemies. If you continue to let the money flow, you'll be able to stay one step ahead of them for years. You'll watch them. You'll listen to them. You'll let them waste valuable time and effort plotting and planning attacks that will never take place. And you'll make arrests only as a last resort, and only if they're necessary to prevent a bomb from exploding or a plane from falling out of the sky."
"The White House disagrees," said Carter.
"So this is political."
"I'd rather not speculate on the motives behind it."
"What about Malik?"
"Malik is a rumor. Malik is a hunch on Dina's part."
Gabriel studied Carter skeptically.
"You don't believe that, Adrian?
After all, you were the one who said the European bombings were planned by someone who cut his teeth in Baghdad."
"And I stand by that. But the goal of this operation was never to find one man. It was to dismantle a terror network. Thanks to your work, we believe we have enough evidence to take down at least 60 operatives in a dozen countries. When was the last time anyone arrested 60 of the bad guys? It's an amazing accomplishment. It's your accomplishment.
Let's just hope they're the right 60 operatives, otherwise it might not stop the next attack. In fact, it might push Rashid and Malik to accelerate their planning."
Carter unwound a paperclip, the last in all of Langley, but said nothing.
"Have you considered what this is going to mean for Nadia's security?"
"It's possible Rashid might find the timing of the arrests suspicious," Carter admitted. "That's why we plan to protect her with a series of well-placed leaks to the press."
"What kind of leaks?"
"The kind that portray the arrests as the culmination of a multi-year investigation that began while Rashid was still in America. We believe it will sow discord inside his inner circle and leave the network paralyzed."
"Do we?"
"That is our hope," said Carter, without a trace of irony in his voice.
"Why wasn't I consulted about any of this?" asked Gabriel.
Carter held up his paperclip, which was now perfectly straight.
"I thought that's what we were doing now."
The conversation was their last for several days. Carter kept to the seventh floor while Gabriel spent most of his time overseeing the withdrawal of his troops from the field. By the end of February, the agency had assumed total responsibility for the physical and electronic surveillance of Nadia al-Bakari and Samir Abbas. Of Gabriel's original operation, nothing remained but a pair of empty safe houses, one in a small village north of Paris, another on the shores of Lake Zurich. Ari Shamron decided to stick Chateau Treville in his back pocket, but ordered the Zurich house shut down. Chiara handled the paperwork herself before flying to Washington to be with Gabriel. They settled into an office flat on Tunlaw Road across the street from the Russian embassy. Carter put a pair of watches on them just to be on the safe side. With Chiara in Washington, Gabriel sharply curtailed the amount of time he spent in Rashidistan. He would arrive at Langley in time for the morning senior staff meeting, then spend a few hours peering over the shoulders of the analysts and the data miners before returning to Georgetown to meet Chiara for lunch. Afterward, if the skies were clear, they would do a bit of shopping, or stroll the pleasant streets discussing their future. At times, it seemed they were merely resuming the conversation that had been interrupted by the bombing in Covent Garden. Chiara even raised the subject of working at Isherwood's gallery.
"Think about it," she said when Gabriel objected. "That's all I'm saying, darling. Just think about it."
For the moment, though, Gabriel could think only of Nadia's security. With Carter's approval, he reviewed the agency's plans for Nadia's long-term protection, and even had a hand in drafting the material that would be leaked to the American press. Mainly, he waged a tireless campaign from within Rashidistan to prevent the arrests from happening, telling anyone who would listen that the agency, by bowing to political pressure, was about to make a catastrophic blunder. Carter stopped attending meetings where Gabriel was present. There was no point. The White House had ordered Carter to bring down the hammer. He was now in constant contact with friends and allies in a dozen countries, coordinating what was to be the single biggest haul of jihadist militants and operatives since the fall of Afghanistan. On a Friday morning in late March, Gabriel pulled him aside long enough to say that he was planning to leave Washington to return to England. Carter suggested Gabriel stay a little longer. Otherwise he was going to miss the big show. "When does it start?" asked Gabriel gloomily. Carter looked at his watch and smiled. Within hours, the dominoes began to fall. They toppled so quickly and on such a wide scale that the press struggled to keep pace with the unfolding story. The first arrests took place in the United States, where FBI SWAT teams executed a series of simultaneous raids in four cities. There was the cell of Egyptians in Newark that was planning to derail a New York-bound Amtrak train, and the cell of Somalis in Minneapolis that was plotting chemical attacks against several downtown office buildings, and the cell of Pakistanis in Denver that was in the final stages of a plot to murder hundreds of people with a series of attacks on crowded sporting facilities. Most alarming, however, was Falls Church, Virginia, where a 6-member cell was in the final stages of a plan to attack the new U.S. Capitol Visitor Center. On one of the suspects' computers, the FBI found casing photos of tourists and schoolchildren waiting to be admitted. Another suspect had recently rented an isolated warehouse to begin preparing the peroxide-based bombs. The money had come from the Algerian in Montreal, who was arrested at the same time, along with 8 other Canadian residents. In Europe, the haul was even larger. In Paris, the terrorists were plotting to attack the Eiffel Tower and the Musée d'Orsay. In London they had targeted the Millennium Wheel and Parliament Square, and in Berlin they were preparing a Mumbai-style assault on visitors to the Holocaust Memorial near the Brandenburg Gate. Copenhagen and Madrid, victimized by the first round of attacks, yielded additional cells. So did Stockholm, Malmö, Oslo and Rome. Across the continent, bank accounts were frozen and businesses were shut down, all thanks to Nadia's money. One by one, prime ministers, presidents, and chancellors appeared before the press to proclaim that disaster had been averted. The American president spoke last. Resolute, he described the threat as the most serious since 9/11 and hinted that more arrests were coming. When asked to describe how the cells had been uncovered, he deferred to his counterterrorism adviser James McKenna, who refused to answer. He went to great pains, however, to point out that the breakthrough had been achieved without resorting to tactics used by the previous administration. "The threat has evolved," declared McKenna, "and so have we." The following morning, the New York Times and the Washington Post carried lengthy articles describing a multi-agency intelligence and law enforcement triumph nearly a decade in the making. In addition, both papers ran editorials lauding the president's 21st century vision for the struggle against global extremism. And by that evening, on the cable talk shows, members of the opposing political party looked disheartened. The president had done more than eliminate a dangerous terror network, said one noteworthy strategist. He had just guaranteed himself another 4 years in office. The race for 2012 was over. It was time to start thinking about 2016. 47. The Palisades, Washington, D.C. That same evening, the CIA director summoned the staff to the bubble, Langley's futuristic auditorium, for a pep rally. Ellis Coyle chose not to attend. Such events, he knew, were as predictable as his nights at home with Nora. There would be the usual drivel about pride restored and an agency on the mend, an agency that had finally found its place in a world without the Soviet Union. Coyle had heard the same speech from 7 previous directors, all of whom had left the CIA weaker and more dysfunctional than they had found it. Drained of talent, weakened by the reorganization of the American intelligence community, the agency was a smoldering ruin. Even Coyle, a professional dissembler, could not sit in the bubble and pretend that the arrest of 60 suspected terrorists heralded a brighter future, especially since he knew the truth about how the breakthrough had been achieved. There was a 4-car pile-up on Canal Road. As a result, Coyle was able to listen to the end of Atlas Shrugged during the drive home. He arrived in the Palisades to find Roger Blankman's house ablaze with a Gatsby-esque light and dozens of luxury cars lining the narrow street. "He's having another party," said Nora, as she accepted Coyle's loveless kiss. "It's a fundraiser of some sort." "I suppose that's why we weren't invited."
"Don't be petty, Ellis. It doesn't suit you."
She added an inch of Merlot to her glass as Lucy entered the kitchen, leash in mouth. Coyle attached it dutifully to her collar, and together they walked to Battery Kemble Park. Near the base of the wooden sign, at a precise 45-degree angle falling left to right, was a chalk mark. It meant there was a package waiting for Coyle at drop site number 3. Coyle rubbed out the mark with the toe of his shoe and entered. It was dark in the trees, but Coyle had no need of a flashlight. He knew the footpath the way a blind man knows the streets around his home. From MacArthur Boulevard, it ran flat for only a few paces before rising sharply up the slope of the hill. At the top of the park was a clearing, where the 100-pound guns of the old battery had once stood. To the right was a narrow tributary spanned by a wooden footbridge. Drop site number 3 was just beyond the bridge, beneath a fallen oak tree. It was difficult to access, especially for a man of early middle age with chronic back problems, but not for Lucy. She knew each of the drop sites by the sound of its spoken number, and could clean them out in a matter of seconds. What's more, unless the Bureau had discovered some way to speak to dogs, she could never be called to testify. Lucy was a perfect field agent, thought Coyle, smart, capable, fearless, and utterly loyal. Coyle paused for a moment to listen to the sound of footfalls or voices. Hearing nothing, he gave Lucy the command to empty drop site 3. She darted into the woods, her black coat rendering her all but invisible, and splashed into the stream bed. A moment later she came scrambling up the embankment with a stick in her mouth and dropped it obediently at Coyle's feet. It was about a foot in length and approximately 2 inches in diameter. Coyle took hold of each end and gave a sharp twist. It came apart easily, revealing a hidden compartment. Inside the compartment was a small slip of paper. Coyle removed it, then reassembled the stick and gave it to Lucy to return to the drop site. In all likelihood, Coyle's handler would collect it before dawn. He wasn't the smartest intelligence officer Coyle had ever encountered, but he was thorough in a plodding sort of way, and he never made Coyle wait for his money. That was hardly surprising. The officer's service faced many threats, both internal and external, but a shortage of money was not one of them. Coyle read the message by the glow of his mobile phone and then dropped the slip of paper into a plastic Safeway bag. It was the same bag he used 5 minutes later to collect Lucy's nightly offering. Tightly knotted, it swung like a pendulum, beating warmly against Coyle's wrist as he strode down the footpath toward home. It wouldn't be long now, he thought. A few more secrets, a few more trips into the park with Lucy at his side. He wondered whether he would really have the nerve to leave. Then he thought of Nora's dowdy eyeglasses and his neighbour's enormous house, and the book about Winston Churchill he had listened to while stuck in traffic. Coyle had always admired Churchill's decisiveness. In the end, Coyle would be decisive too. Across the river at Langley, the party continued for much of the next week. They celebrated their hard work. They celebrated the superiority of their technology. They celebrated the fact that they had finally managed to outwit their enemy. Mainly, though, they celebrated Adrian Carter. The operation, they said, would surely be regarded as one of Carter's finest. The black marks had been erased. The sins had been forgiven. Never mind that Rashid and Malik were still out there somewhere. For now, they were terrorists without a network. And it was all Carter's doing. Rashidistan remained open for business, but its ranks were thinned by a wave of hasty reassignments. What had begun as a highly secretive intelligence-gathering endeavour was now a matter largely for policemen and prosecutors. The team no longer tracked the flow of money through a terror network. Instead, it engaged in heated debates with lawyers from the Justice Department over what evidence was admissible and what should never see the light of day. None of the lawyers bothered to ask the opinion of Gabriel Allon, the legendary but wayward son of Israeli intelligence, because none knew he was there. With the operation winding down, Gabriel devoted most of his time and energy to leaving it. At the request of King Saul Boulevard, he conducted a series of exit briefings and negotiated a permanent system of sharing the intelligence harvest, knowing full well the Americans would never live up to the terms. The accord was signed with great fanfare in a sparsely attended ceremony in the director's office, after which Gabriel proceeded to the office of personnel to hand in his green credentials. What should have taken 5 minutes consumed more than an hour as he was forced to sign countless written promises, none of which he had any intention of keeping. When personnel's lust for ink had finally been satisfied, a uniformed guard escorted Gabriel down to the lobby. He remained there for a few minutes to watch a new star being carved into the CIA's memorial wall, then headed into the first violent thunderstorm of Washington's all-too-brief spring. By the time Gabriel reached Georgetown, the rain had ended and the sun was again shining brightly. He met Chiara for lunch at a quaint outdoor café near American University, then walked her back to Tunlaw Road to pack for the flight home. Arriving at the apartment building, they found an armoured black Escalade waiting outside the entrance, its tailpipe gently smoking. A hand beckoned. It belonged to Adrian Carter.
"Is there a problem?" asked Gabriel.
"I suppose that depends entirely on how you look at it."
"Can you get to the point, Adrian? We have a plane to catch."
"Actually, I've taken the liberty of cancelling your reservations."
"How thoughtful of you."
"Get in."
Part 3. The Empty Quarter. 48. The Plains, Virginia. The house stood on the highest point of the land, shaded by a coppice of oak and elm. It had a tarnished copper roof and a handsome double-decker porch overlooking a green pasture. The neighbours had been led to believe that the owner was a wealthy Washington lobbyist named Hewitt. There was no Washington lobbyist named Hewitt, at least not one associated with a charming 40-acre gentleman's farm located 2 miles east of the Plains, on Country Road 601. The name had been chosen randomly by the computers of the Central Intelligence Agency, which owned and operated the farm through a front company. The agency also owned the John Deere tractor, the Ford pickup truck, the Bush Hog rotary cutter, and a pair of bay horses. One was named Colby, the other was called Helms. According to agency wits, they were subjected, like all CIA employees, to annual polygraphs to make certain they hadn't switched sides, whatever side that might be. The following afternoon, both horses were nibbling on the new grass in the lower pasture as the Escalade bearing Gabriel and Chiara came churning up the long gravel drive. A CIA security man admitted them into the house, then, after relieving them of their coats and mobile devices, pointed them toward the great room. Entering, they saw Uzi Navot peering longingly at the buffet and Ari Shamron attempting to coax a cup of coffee from the pump-action thermos. Seated near the dormant fireplace, dressed for a long weekend in the English countryside, was Graham Seymour. Adrian Carter sat next to him, frowning at something James McKenna was whispering urgently in his ear. The men gathered in the room represented a secret brotherhood of sorts. Since the attacks of 9/11, they had worked together on numerous joint operations, most of which the public knew nothing about. They had fought for one another, killed for one another, and in some cases bled for one another. Despite the occasional disagreement, their bond had managed to transcend time and the fickle whims of their political masters. They saw their mission in stark terms. They were, to borrow a phrase from their enemy, the Shura Council of the civilized world. They took on the unpleasant chores no one else was willing to perform, and worried about the consequences later, especially when lives were at stake. James McKenna was not a member of the council, nor would he ever be. He was a political animal, which meant by definition he was part of the problem. His presence promised to be a complicating factor, especially if he planned to spend the entire time whispering in Carter's ear. McKenna was clearly most comfortable when seated at a rectangular table, so at his suggestion they moved into the formal dining room. It was obvious why Carter did not like him. McKenna was everything Carter was not. He was young, he was fit, he looked good behind a podium. He was also supremely sure of himself, regardless of whether that certainty was warranted or supported by the facts. McKenna had no blood on his hands and no professional sins in his past. He had never confronted his enemy over the barrel of a gun or questioned him in an interrogation room. He didn't even speak any of his enemy's languages. Yet he had read many briefing books about him and had spoken with great sensitivity about him in many meetings. His main contribution to the literature of counterterrorism was a piece he had once written for Foreign Affairs magazine in which he argued the United States could absorb another terrorist attack and emerge stronger for it. The piece had captured the attention of a charismatic senator, and when the senator became president, he placed much of the responsibility for the country's safety in the hands of a political hack who had once spent a week at Langley getting coffee for the director. There ensued an awkward moment over who would sit at the head of the table, Carter or McKenna. In the unwritten rules of the Brotherhood, chairmanship of meetings was determined by geography, but there were no bylaws about what to do when confronted by a political interloper. Eventually, McKenna surrendered the head of the table to Carter, and settled in next to Graham Seymour, who seemed to threaten him less than the quartet of Israelis. Carter placed his pipe and his tobacco pouch on the table for later deployment, then lifted the lid of a secure notebook computer. Stored on its hard drive was a copy of an NSA intercept. It was a phone call placed at 10:36 a.m. Central European Time the previous day, between the Zurich branch of Transarabian Bank and the Paris offices of AAB Holdings. The parties to the call had been Samir Abbas, a banker with uncomfortably close ties to questionable Islamic charities, and his new client, Nadia Al-Bakari. They had spoken for 2 minutes and 12 seconds, in formal Arabic. Carter distributed copies of an NSA translation. Then he pulled up the audio file on the computer and clicked play. The first voice on the recording belonged to Nadia's executive secretary, who asked Abbas to hold while she transferred the call. Nadia picked up exactly 6 seconds later. After the obligatory Islamic expression of peace, Abbas said he had just spoken to an associate of the Yemeni. It seemed the Yemeni's enterprise had suffered a string of recent setbacks and was in desperate need of additional financing. The associate wished to appeal to Nadia personally and was willing to discuss future plans, including several pending deals in America. This associate, whom Abbas described as extremely close to the Yemeni, had suggested Dubai as a meeting site. Apparently he was a frequent visitor to the fabulously rich emirate, and even kept a modest apartment in the Jumeirah Beach district. Needless to say, the associate of the Yemeni was well aware of Miss Al-Bakari's security concerns, and would be willing to meet her in a place where she would feel both safe and comfortable.
Where?
The Burj Al Arab.
When?
A week from Thursday.
I'm supposed to be in Istanbul that day on business.
The associate's schedule is very busy. It will be his one and only chance to meet with you for the foreseeable future.
When does he need an answer?
I'm afraid he needs it now.
What time would he like to see me?
9 in the evening.
My bodyguards won't permit any changes.
The associate assures me there won't be any.
Then please tell him I'll be at the Burj next Thursday evening at 9 p.m. and tell him not to be late, because I never invest money with people who are late for meetings.
I assure you he won't be late.
Will there be anyone else in attendance?
Just me. Unless, of course, you would rather go alone.
Actually, I would prefer it if you came.
Then I would be honored to be at your side. I'll be waiting in the lobby. You have my mobile number.
I'll see you next Thursday, inshallah.
Inshallah, Miss Al-Bakari. Carter clicked pause.
The next recording is a call that was placed to Samir's home just 6 hours earlier. He was sleeping soundly at the time and wasn't pleased when the phone rang. His mood changed when he heard the voice at the other end. The gentleman never bothered to identify himself. He placed the call from Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, using a cell phone that had no history and no longer seems to be operative. There's some dropout and a great deal of background noise. Here's a sample.
Carter clicked play.
Tell her we need more money. Tell her we're willing to discuss future plans. Make it clear that we're sending someone important.
Pause.
So, who exactly is the close associate of the Yemeni who wishes to meet with Nadia?
Carter asked rhetorically.
This phone call appears to provide the answer. It took a bit of work because of the poor quality, but NSA was able to manipulate the recording and conduct voice match analysis. They ran it through every database we have, including databases of radio and cell phone communications collected in Iraq during the height of the insurgency. 1 hour ago, they came up with a match. Anyone care to venture a guess as to the identity of the man Samir Abbas was speaking to?
I'm tempted to say it was Malik Al-Zubair, Gabriel said. But that's not possible. You see, Adrian, Malik is a rumor. Malik is a hunch on Dina's part.
No, he's not, Carter conceded. Dina was right. Malik is for real. He was in Jeddah 2 days ago, and he may or may not be coming to the Burj Al Arab Hotel in Dubai next Thursday evening to have a word with his new patron, Nadia Al-Bakari. The question is, what do we do about it?
Carter rapped his pipe against the rim of his ashtray. The Shura Council was now in session. 49. The Plains, Virginia. It was an American operation, which meant it was an American decision to make. McKenna clearly had no intention of offering the first opinion, lest the ground shift suddenly beneath his feet, so he adroitly deferred to Carter, who began, in typical Carter fashion, with a detour. It was to a place called Ford Operating Base Chapman, a CIA post in remote eastern Afghanistan, where, in December 2009, a CIA asset named Humam Khalil Abu Mulal al-Bolawi came calling to deliver a report to his handlers. A Jordanian physician with links to the jihadist movement, Dr. Balawi had been providing the CIA with critical information used to target al-Qaeda militants in Pakistan. His true mission, however, was to penetrate the CIA and Jordanian intelligence, a mission that came to a disastrous conclusion that day when he detonated a bomb hidden beneath his coat, killing 7 CIA officers. It was among the worst single attacks against the agency in its history, and certainly the worst during Adrian Carter's long career as Director of Operations. It demonstrated that al-Qaeda was willing to expend extraordinary time and effort to exact revenge against the intelligence services that pursued it, and it proved that when spies ignore the basic rules of tradecraft, officers could end up dead.
"Are you suggesting that Nadia al-Bakari is in league with al-Qaeda?" asked McKenna.
"I'm suggesting nothing of the sort. In fact, it is my opinion that when the secret history of the global war on terror is finally written, Nadia will be regarded as one of the most valuable assets who ever worked on the side of the West. Which is why I would hate to lose her because we got greedy and sent her into a situation we shouldn't have."
"Malik isn't inviting her to South Waziristan," McKenna said. "He's asking to meet with her in one of the most famous hotels in the world."
"Actually," Carter replied, "we don't know whether it's going to be Malik al-Zubair or nobody al-nobody, but that's beside the point."
"What is the point?"
"It violates tradecraft. You remember tradecraft, don't you, Jim? Rule 1 says we control as many environmental factors as possible. We choose the time. We choose the place. We pick out the furniture.
We order the drinks. And, if possible, we serve the drinks. And we sure as hell don't let someone like Nadia al-Bakari get within a country mile of a man like Malik.
But sometimes we play the hand we're dealt, McKenna countered. Isn't that what you told the president the day after we lost those 7 CIA officers?
Gabriel noticed a rare flash of anger in Carter's eyes, but when he spoke again his voice was as calm and underpowered as ever.
My father was an Episcopal minister, Jim. I don't play cards.
Then what are you recommending?
This operation has worked better than any of us ever dared to hope, Carter said. Maybe we shouldn't push our luck with a risky pass play late in the fourth quarter.
Shamron appeared annoyed. He considered the use of American sports metaphors to be inappropriate for a business as vital as espionage. In Shamron's opinion, intelligence officers did not blow fourth-quarter leads, or strike out, or fumble the ball. There was only success or failure, and the price of failure in a neighborhood like the Middle East was usually blood.
"Call it a day?" Shamron asked. "Is that what you're saying, Adrian?"
"Why not? The president got his victory, and so did the agency. Better still, everybody lives to fight another day."
Carter brushed the palms of his hands together twice and said, "Halas." McKenna seemed perplexed. Gabriel explained the reference to him.
"Halas is the Arabic word for finished. But Adrian knows all too well that this war will never be finished. It's a forever war. And he's afraid it will be a good deal bloodier if he allows a skilled mastermind like Malik to slip through his fingers.
No one wants Malik's head on a pike more than I do, Carter agreed. He deserves it for the mayhem he caused in Iraq, and his removal from the face of the earth will make us all safer. Suicide bombers are a dime a dozen, but masterminds, true terror masterminds, are extremely hard to replace. Eliminate the masterminds like Malik, and you're left with a bunch of jihadist wannabes trying to figure out how to mix their peroxide bombs in their mother's basement.
So why not let Nadia make the meeting? Asked McKenna. Why not let her listen to what Malik has to say about his future plans?
Because I've got that funny feeling at the back of my neck.
But they trust her. Why wouldn't they? She's Zizi's daughter. She's a descendant of Wahhab himself, for God's sake.
I'll grant you they trusted her once, Carter replied. But it's an open question whether they trust her now that their network has been rolled up.
You're jumping at shadows, McKenna said. But I suppose that's to be expected. After all, you've been at this a very long time. For the last 10 years you've been reading their email and listening to their phone conversations, looking for hidden meaning. But sometimes there is none. Sometimes a wedding is just a wedding, and sometimes a meeting in a hotel is just a meeting in a hotel. Besides, if we can't get a heavily guarded businesswoman like Nadia al-Bakari in and out of the Burj al Arab safely, then maybe we're in the wrong business.
Carter was silent for a moment.
Any chance we can keep this professional, Jim?
I thought we were.
Should I assume you're speaking for the White House?
No, said McKenna. You should assume I'm speaking for the president.
Since you're so in tune with the president's thinking, why don't you tell us all what the president wants?
He wants what all presidents want. He wants a second term. Otherwise the inmates will be running the asylum again, and all the progress we've made in the war against terrorism will be wiped away.
You mean extremism, said Carter, correcting him. But what about the meeting in Dubai?
Both the president and I would like her to attend, with the good guys looking over her shoulder, of course. Listen to what he has to say. Take his picture. Get his fingerprints, record his voice, determine whether he's Malik or some other heavyweight member of the network.
And what do we tell our friends in the Emirati security services?
Our friends in the Emirates have been less than reliable allies on a number of issues, ranging from terrorism to money laundering to the illicit arms trade. Besides, in my experience, one never quite knows just whom one is speaking to in the Emirates. He might be a committed opponent of the jihadists, or he might be a second cousin once removed.
So we say nothing? Carter asked.
Nothing,
McKenna replied.
And if we determine it's Malik?
Then the president would like him taken out of circulation.
What does that mean?
Use your imagination, Adrian.
I did that after 9/11, Jim.
You said publicly that I should be put in jail for it. So if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to know exactly what the President is asking me to do.
It was Shamron, not McKenna, who answered.
He is not asking you to do anything, Adrian.
Shamron looked at McKenna and asked,
Isn't that correct?
I was told to watch my step around you.
I was told the same thing.
McKenna seemed pleased by this.
The President is unwilling to authorize an American covert action in a quasi-friendly Arab country at a sensitive time like this, he said. He feels it could embarrass the regime and thus leave it vulnerable to the forces of change sweeping the Middle East.
But Israelis running amok in Dubai is another matter entirely.
It does happen to dovetail nicely with the facts.
What facts are those?
Malik has a great deal of Israeli blood on his hands, which means you have every reason to want him dead.
Well played, Mr. McKenna,
Shamron said.
But what do we get in return?
The gratitude of the most important and transformative American president in a generation.
Equity?
Asked Shamron. McKenna smiled and said, Equity. 50. The Plains, Virginia. It was at this point in the proceedings that James A. McKenna, Special Assistant to the President for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism, thankfully chose to take his leave. Carter summoned his secret brethren to the sitting room and asked whether anyone could recall where Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, mastermind of the 9/11 plot, had been hiding the night of his capture. They all did, of course, but it was Chiara who answered.
He was in a house in Rawalpindi, just down the road from the headquarters of the Pakistani military.
Of all places,
Carter said, shaking his head.
And do you happen to remember how we got him?
You sent in an informant to confirm it was really him. After laying eyes on the target, the informant slipped into the bathroom and sent you a text message.
And a few hours later, the man who planned the worst terror attack in history was in handcuffs, looking shockingly like the guy who works on my wife's Volvo. I took a great deal of grief for the things we did to KSM and the places we put him. But that picture of him being led away was worth it all. And all it took was a guy with a cell phone. Simple as that.
If we agree to do this, Gabriel said, you may rest assured Nadia won't be running to the toilet to send any text messages.
If you agree to do it.
Carter inclined his head toward Shamron and Navot, who were seated next to each other on the couch, with their arms folded and their faces set in the same inscrutable mask.
They're very good at hiding their thoughts, Carter said, but I can tell you exactly what's running through their devious little minds. They want Malik in the worst way, maybe even more than the President and McKenna, and there's no way they're going to pass up a chance of getting him. So let's skip the playing hard to get portion of tonight's performance, and get down to the planning.
Gabriel looked to his superiors for guidance. Navot was rubbing at the spot on the bridge of his nose where his fashionable eyeglasses pinched him. Shamron had yet to move. He was staring past Gabriel toward Chiara, as if offering her a chance to intervene. She didn't take it.
For the record, Gabriel said, we're not going to Dubai to capture anyone. If it's Malik, he won't leave there alive.
I'm quite certain I didn't hear McKenna mention anything about an arrest.
Just so we're clear.
We are,
said Carter.
Think of yourself as a hellfire missile, but without the collateral damage and innocent deaths.
Hellfire missiles don't need passports, hotel rooms, and airline tickets. They also don't have a problem operating in Arab countries.
We do.
Gabriel paused.
You do realize that Dubai is an Arab country, don't you, Adrian?
I think I may have read something about that.
Gabriel hesitated. They were now about to enter sensitive territory, dealing with capabilities and operational tendencies. Intelligence agencies guard these secrets jealously and expose them to allies only under duress. For the office it was akin to heresy. With a nod, Gabriel delegated the task to Uzi Navot, who slipped on his eyeglasses again and stared at Carter for a long moment without speaking.
We live in a complex world, Adrian,
he said finally.
"So sometimes it helps to simplify things. As far as we are concerned, there are two types of countries. Places where we can operate with impunity and places where we can't. We call the first category base countries. Like the United States," Carter acknowledged with a smile. "And the United Kingdom," Navot added, with a glance toward the deputy director of MI5. "Despite your best efforts, we come and go as needed and do pretty much as we please. If we get into trouble, we have a network of safe houses and bolt holes that were put in place by the man seated at my side. In the event of a disaster, God forbid, our agents can take sanctuary in an embassy or ask for help from a friendly secret policeman like Graham." Shamron gave Navot a murderous look. Navot carried on as though he hadn't noticed. "We refer to the second category as target countries. These are hostile lands. No embassies, no safe houses. The secret policemen aren't friendly. In fact, were they to get their hands on us, they would torture us, shoot us, hang us on television for their people to see, or put us in jail for a very long time."
"What do you need?" asked Carter.
"Passports," said Gabriel, taking over for Navot. "The kind that allow us to enter Dubai without an advance visa."
"What flavor?"
"American, British, Canadian, Australian."
"Why Canadian and Aussie?" asked Graham Seymour.
"Because we're going to need a large team, and I need to spread them out geographically."
"Why not use your own false passports?"
This time it was Shamron who answered.